To acknowledge our university and community supporters, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their financial support. And I thank today's special sponsors, Midwest One Bank, Ken and Alice Atkinson, and Conrad Schultz. I also thank City Channel 4 in the back for professionally recording our programs for cablecast on City Channel 4 or 118-2, and the U of I Library's Digital Archives for maintaining all of our past programs where you can go watch. This time it is my pleasure to introduce Will Coghorn-Behrens, who I have actually known, and we have had the experience of watching our children grow up together. So it's great fun to be able to introduce him. He is the co-director of the Baker Teacher Leader Education, Leader Center at the U of I College of Education, with a particular focus on global community education initiatives, a new effort to internationalize in the College of Education. He was a classroom teacher of German in Iowa City and in Wutapol. Close enough? If I'm saying it right, Wutapol, Germany?
Wuppertal.
Sorry, Germany, prior to his College of Education experience here in Iowa City. He has presented on teacher education and professional development internationally and nationally. He is the co-author of three books with Rebecca Anthony on professional development and career advancement in both K-12 and higher education. Dr. Coghill-Behrens will describe new programs and initiatives in the College of Education focused on enhancing the skill set of future educators, which is broadly conceived, and to promote global citizenship and intercultural competencies in future classrooms and workplaces. This particular presentation will focus on the most recent visit to the country formerly known as the Kingdom of Swaziland, Eswatini. Thank you. It seems like a perfect presentation for today. So please join me in welcoming Will Coghill-Behrens.
Thank you so much. So thank you for that welcome, Jana. It was really awesome to see that you would be introducing me. And thank you for the invitation to speak, Janice, who's here with us also today. Like Janet indicated, I am co-director of the Baker Teacher Leader Center. And in the College of Education, I hold a faculty appointment in foreign language and ESL education. I am a German teacher. I'm trained also to speak and teach Russian. But don't ask me anything in Russian because German has been my primary focus. So I'm here to talk to you today about some new initiatives in partnership with international programs in the College of Education as we seek to internationalize and globalize our curriculum. I think everybody in this room would agree we're living in very interesting times, to say the least, and that the imperative is really on us to think about ways in which we can certainly provide opportunities, especially for pre-service and in-service teachers, to learn about curricular methods, pedagogies, et cetera, to help them prepare students for the world that they are inheriting. So, one of the things that I think is important to remember when we talk about this work, when we talk about internationalization, especially when we're looking at it sort of on the micro level like we will today, is that our stories matter. Each of us comes to this room, to this luncheon, to this experience, to this world, to this community with life experiences and stories. And those stories help shape who we are, and they shape the stories that we co-create with other people in this process. And so I'm going to tell a story today. And it's an incomplete story, meaning there are lots of things about the story that even I recognize are in development, hence the title, right? This is really a dispatch about the developmental process and creating new programming and new opportunities for students in complicated places in the world, like the developing world and the developing nation of Eswatini. So a little bit more about my background so you can understand my story and where I'm coming from. I remember distinctly the first time in my life when I sort of had and understood that there was this thing called otherness, right? That there were people who were different than us. And it was at our dinner table. I was in the fourth grade and we were learning about the Soviet Union. So this probably would have been, I don't know, 1986, 87, right? There were lots of exciting things happening in the world at that time, as many of you know. And I remember having this conversation with my dad and my mom, where I said to them, so I'm kind of confused, right? Like the textbook and the materials that my teacher is sharing with me present these people, right, these Soviets as like normal, right, with traditions and customs and values. I remember one particular picture of a family sitting at the table drinking chai, tea. My family, we were never really tea drinkers, but we were in the moment of that conversation, sitting around at a table having a conversation. And I remember distinctly my dad saying to me, you know, they aren't different from us. They live somewhere else. They speak a different language, right? But they're on the same, I think, I don't know if he used this expression, but struggle bus, right? As we all are, right? They're trying to make ends meet. They're trying to make sense of the world. And what you're seeing on TV, you know, what you're hearing about in the media is not the full and complete story. Perhaps my dad was already onto something called fake news. I don't know. But needless to say, I remember distinctly that being sort of this transitional and transformational moment in my life. Fast forward to high school, I had the fortune of having some really, really phenomenal German teachers, and was in German 4, and I was always like a pretty good student, you know, A's and B's. And I must have like not been doing so hot in German because my teacher announced this scholarship program called the Congress Bundestag Exchange Program. And I thought, I'm going to apply for that. Really not even thinking of what it would mean to actually study abroad and leave my comfort zone for 6 months or a year. And so I completed the application. Well, I ended up getting not the full Congress Bundestag ride, the full year, but a 6 month partial scholarship. And so I went to my parents and I sort of showed them and shared with them this great news. And at that point in time, you know, for my parents to cough up the amount of money that they did for me to have that experience, I think takes me back to that day that we were sitting at the table when I was in fourth grade, right? My parents really believed in and valued that experience. And so I don't know if my dad is now unfortunately deceased, if my mom will ever watch this, but Mom, thank you for everything, because I really wouldn't be here without that kind of experience. So here I was, a German 4 student. I was, of course, totally fluent in German. And I was 100% ready to take this on. And so we get on the plane, we fly to Germany, and the first night we were all there in this sort of Studentenwohnheim, like a dormitory together overnight. And there were lots of kids there who didn't have any German. And so that was sort of reinforcing this really false idea that I was, again, 100% fluent in German. I knew everything there was to know about Germany, right? Because I had studied 4 years and I had really excellent teachers. And so before I went, like a good student, I did my homework. And I knew that I was going to be going to a place called Oldenburg, which is in the northern part of Germany. What I didn't notice was that behind that word Oldenburg were two other words that were really important. In Holstein. And I don't know how many of you are German speakers here understand this, but Oldenburg, that name, is a little bit like Springfield is in the United States, right? So like every state has one. And so this entire time, I was looking at this map in my totally naive, you know, German 4 mind thinking, oh my God, I'm going to a relatively large city that has a university. So I'm going to be living in like this cool, like metropolitan, like Iowa City or something. And having grown up in Bettendorf, that felt really exciting to me. So we get to Germany again. The next morning, they put us on these buses. We head up north. Several hours we were in the bus. And I meet my host family for the first time, Erhard, Mari, and Kayen. We get in the car. We go have dinner at their house. They introduce me to something which I now adore but then detested. I thought they were trying to kill me, called Stinkerkäse. Maybe just think about the most pungent sort of aromatic cheese you can possibly think of. At any rate, we had dinner, and then we went for a walk. Now remember, I'm still thinking that I am in Oldenburg, which is a big city in northern Germany. So we go down the street, and I'm noticing, you know, houses on either side of the street, and beyond the houses, I'm seeing fields and cows and stuff like this. We get to the end of the street, we turn around, and we walk to the other end of the city. And again, same scene on both sides of the houses, you know, fields, etc. And we turn around and I look at them and I said in my really sort of terrible and simple German, wo ist das Stadtzentrum? which for those of you who speak German means, you know, like, where's downtown? Where's the city center? So I then learned that I was actually nowhere near Oldenburg, the big city. I was near Oldenburg in Holstein, and actually a small village called Kramdorf. And so my host parents sort of giggled and looked at me and said, well, actually, our house is kind of in the Stadtzentrum, except we probably wouldn't say Stadtzentrum. We probably would say, like, Dorfzentrum, but nobody ever says that in Germany. So this was my first lesson, right? And that is Germans don't actually speak German for in Germany. They actually speak German. And there are lots and lots of different places in Germany that are not necessarily the places that were on the walls of my German 4 classroom. I say this because now looking back as a teacher, I'm thinking about, you know, all the kinds of assumptions and naive ideas that our students in our classrooms build and create and co-create. This is something that really drives me in the work that I do today in the College of Education, which is getting teachers sort of outside of the safe space of the classroom, right, that protective bubble, and putting them into experiences, putting them into the real life Germany, putting them into the real life different kinds of places that they will find. So that's why I'm here today, and that's what drives my work. So as indicated, I've been a classroom teacher of German for a while here in Iowa City, picture of my awesome students, who I miss dearly. I also co-direct the Baker Teacher Leader Center. We're a professional development center, primarily for pre-service teachers, but we also do work with in-service teachers. Our mission in the center is to create future-ready teachers. And I know that that sounds a little bit cliche, but it's incredibly important because we know that the curriculum that the state provides, because we're a licensure program, our curriculum is approved by the state, is never quite in step with what is actually happening in the real world, right? And so we have created to that end a series of surveys and focus groups with school administrators to ask them, what really are you looking for in new teachers as they enter your classroom? What skills sets do they need that they may not be getting from our traditional curriculum or that we can add to or advance with in a co-curricular sort of way with our curriculum. And so that's what we do. We focus on events that support community building and bringing people together from diverse backgrounds and experiences. And our PD is always sort of nestled within the context of the communities in which our students will be working and teaching. Professional development, thank you. We also are incredibly committed to this idea that our professional development must be representative of the multiple, complex, and myriad identities that our students will encounter as future teachers. And to that end, we're sort of always thinking about this idea and this notion of perspective and what's important. We do licensure renewal for teachers. Pictured here is Christy Vilsack, former Iowa First Lady, and a project we did with her a couple of years ago on a book project, USAID. And now sort of is the guts of my presentation. So pictured here is Dr. Don Whitehead of the American Association for American Colleges and Universities, who was on campus last week to deliver a series of workshops on comprehensive internationalization. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but comprehensive internationalization through the ACE, Center for Internationalization and Global Engagement, focuses on six primary tenets of internationalization across colleges and institutions. And if you can imagine, these bullets represent the kinds of work that we will really be digging into in our college over the course of the next several years as we seek to internationalize. So an articulated institutional commitment, Dr. Thomas and his team at International Programs has done a really phenomenal job of articulating sort of a broader university mission and vision for internationalization. And what we're doing is sort of taking that work that's already been done on our campus and bringing it to our college, right? And saying, you know, what can we copy? What can we replicate? You know, what is working for us? And certainly what is maybe unique about our particular situation. We have a lot of licensure programs in the College of Education, and for that reason, it's important to make sure that we're integrating this in a meaningful way. We're examining our leadership structure and staffing sort of arrangements, right, to make sure that they're all supportive of internationalization efforts. We're looking at our curriculum, and that means really doing deep deep dives into our curriculum across all of our programmatic areas to look at the ways in which some values, which I'll get into here in a little bit, are sort of reflected and exemplified in that curriculum. And then also looking at our co-curricular opportunities, which would also be events like this, right? So I'm not seeing very many College of Education students in attendance right now, but I know that many of them don't have class at this particular time. And so you can bet your bottom that I will be making sure we get more College of Education students here because, like Janet was saying, you know, there are some topics that you read that are happening in the community and you might think, oh, I don't know if that really is for me, but we know that the more students have exposure to this kind of thing, the more they take away. Remember, teachers are teaching in complex worlds anymore, right? So when I was a German teacher, I didn't just teach German, right? I taught a lot of different things. And when we think about really creating a curriculum and an ideal learning environment that's interdisciplinary and provides students ways to better make these connections, which, by the way, is more and more important all the time, we hope that they get exposure to that kind of thing exactly. So we're looking at faculty policy and practices, right? How are we supporting our faculty in this work? What can we do to provide and meet faculty needs? Student mobility, which is not just about getting students to study abroad or, as some say, study away, but also to think about how student lives, right? The lives and the context and the situations that they experience might impact these opportunities, right? And so our approach is one to develop sort of a menu of opportunities that speak to different circumstances and interests and goals. And foundationally, collaboration and partnerships are super important because without them, we don't do this work alone. One of the key takeaways from my time in Swaziland was this concept of Ubuntu, right, which is this idea that collectively we are better than we are as individually. So I mentioned just a minute ago these dimensions of global learning. These are value rubric, which is valid assessment for learning in undergraduate education, also by the Association of American Colleges and Universities. I know that I'm preaching to the choir when I address these, but just very briefly, because they again help set the context for the rest of the talk, we want our opportunities to provide students an enhanced sense of global self-awareness, right? So understanding who they are as cultural beings and how that relates to others, cultural identities and experiences, this idea of perspective taking, right? And that perspective is never stable. It's really a fluid construct. And again, as our stories grow, as our life histories emerge and become something both individual and special and unique, also shared, however, that perspective taking is a skill that one develops over a lifetime. Cultural diversity, again, pretty straightforward. You know, what are the elements of diversity, cultural diversity, and what are the diversities that we all share or experience individually? Personal and social responsibility, I sort of liken this one to the Asia Society's tenet of taking action, right? But helping students understand that they both have personal and social responsibilities in this world in which they live. Global systems are complex, dynamic, interdependent, right? And both within our control and sometimes outside of our control. And sometimes that level of control is sort of a perception thing, right? I'm thinking about global climate change. And lastly, the application of knowledge and skill to this. We're doing all of this work sort of also aligned with the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and in particular, goal number 4, right, which is this idea that we want to ensure inclusive and equitable quality education and promote lifelong learning opportunities for all students, right? And so as our programs continue to develop, we're thinking, trying to think really sort of globally about, you know, what does this mean, and how can the College of Education not just serve our students, right, but what is our engagement and role in the community in terms of establishing partnerships and creating learning opportunities for everybody. So very briefly, again, just sort of as a matter of context, the College of Education overall does actually pretty well in terms of sending students abroad or sending students away. Now, I know that this might look like, the college only sends 3% of students away, but the number and the percentage is actually much larger. But I do like this graphic because I do think it speaks to one of our imperatives, and it's an imperative that I'm going to ask all of you to sort of join in on, which is to encourage more study abroad and encourage more study away. I think the University of Iowa does a good job compared to our peers, but we want to do better, and I think we can do better. there are obviously some barriers, right? And some of these barriers are sort of general to study abroad and study away opportunities, and some of them are unique to our students in the College of Education. Obviously, scheduling is one. Given the complex curriculum, state mandated, by the way, curriculum that our students have to complete, our students sometimes have a hard time fitting in a study abroad experience unless they've been 100% planful from day one. But remember that story about how I thought I was a fluent speaker of German after German 4, right? I think we know that when students get to campus, they're bombarded with all sorts of ideas and activities and initiatives, et cetera, right? And sometimes, you know, thinking about planning and being mindful, I mean, just remember how you thought about things when you were 18, 19, 20 years old, right? That can be complicated. There is a perception that there are these cost barriers. And indeed, study abroad in a way is not necessarily cheap, but there are certainly affordable opportunities on our campus, and that's one of a really important factor that's driving our work. Whether students take credit or non-credit programs, again, our students essentially have a fully packed and mandated curriculum. And so there is this this question about, you know, to what extent can we still afford students these opportunities, but maybe think differently about how we're structuring things like credit, but yet still acknowledge it on the transcript. Our students have a tremendous clinical load. And the other complication about their clinical load is that, again, there is and has been this historical perception that for somebody to become a teacher in Iowa, all of their teaching experiences have to happen in Iowa, meaning all of their clinicals. And what we actually know in working through the state is that that is like totally a false assumption. There are a couple of things that maybe need to happen locally and in specific kinds of clinical environments, but this really actually opens the door to thinking about how can we provide clinical experiences away as well. And lastly, location of programs. You know, we have a variety of students in our college. And some of them are able to travel away, and some of them have families, and they can't necessarily leave. And so that's an important consideration. In the end, why is all of this necessary? This is necessary because, as Vivian Stewart, Vice President for Education at the Asia Society, says, one of the key deterrents to developing a pipeline of young people prepared to develop advanced language proficiency and a deep knowledge of countries and cultures is a lack of trained teachers. We know that in order to get here where we want to with our society, with folks, with our citizenry, that we have to really think about what are we doing to train teachers to get there, right? So that's really what's driving much of this. So why Eswatini? So funny story. I was in my office one day working, and I get an email forward from my DEO, Leah Plackens, faculty member in foreign language ESL, that was sort of a reply-all response to this woman who had emailed her, Dr. Annie Todd, who had done lots and lots of work in Eswatini with nursing students and healthcare, a bit in education. Leah's reply to her made me think that they were like best friends from high school or something. It was so friendly and so kind. So I immediately got on the phone with Annie and we chatted, and I learned that they didn't know each other, but it was okay because we actually ended up having such a phenomenal conversation. And she sold me on taking students to Eswatini. Now, one of the things that is sort of complicated to talk about is how different Siswati culture is, right, in terms of lots of things that are in direct contrast with what I would call fundamental Western values, right? One of them being sort of the patriarchal structure of the society. Polygamy is a norm in Eswatini, and that poses lots of challenges. And of course, I'm trying to be in many ways respectful as I talk about this, but it's very clear and apparent when you're working with teachers there and with families and with some of the children I'll talk about that there are certainly cultural structures that present what I think many of us would call as challenges and barriers to these people. Regardless, one of the tremendous connections of one of the tremendous reasons why I was immediately enamored by Annie and her organization's work there is that it was really, really interdisciplinary. And so remember that thing I said a little bit ago about how we need to work hard to make sure that we're creating these interdisciplinary educational opportunities. Well, we were working in hospitals, we were working in orphanages, we were working in refugee camps, we were working in regular public schools. And so there was this tremendous breadth of different kinds of learning environments that we were going to be able to expose our students to that felt like it was a go. Eswatini is a very safe country, relatively speaking, and it's a very affordable country. And so for all of these reasons, I thought, you know what, let's give it a try. Let's see what we have to lose. There are other programs on campus. I know nursing has had or is developing a program in Eswatini. And so there is sort of already some established Iowa-Swaziland connections. By the way, throughout the presentation, I may sort of vacillate between Eswatini and Swaziland. So in April of 2018, the king, Mswati III, who is, again, absolute monarch, was an anointed leader of king of Swaziland, decided to change the name. And this came as a big surprise to everybody. And so before going to Swaziland, I just did it. Before going to Eswatini, I always said Eswatini, Eswatini, Siswati, right? But when I got there, basically nobody ever said that. Nobody ever called it that. And so I might vacillate between Swaziland, Eswatini, and that's sort of the background there. For those of you who don't know, Swaziland is in southern Africa, sandwiched between Mozambique and South Africa. It's, again, the last absolute monarchy in Africa. Capital is Mbabane. The largest city, however, is Manzini, which is just sort of to the south and, I guess, east of Mbabane. There are about 1 million people in Swaziland, and it's a developing nation, most definitely. And, again, one of the things that drew us to this place was also the unique sort of healthcare needs in this place. Swaziland has the highest incident of adult HIV and AIDS infection rates in the world, with nearly 27% of the adult population reportedly positive. Now, when you are there, you realize that that statistics cannot be trusted. And from what we hear from many people that we worked with there, there is a really good chance that that the statistics are actually much higher. For this reason, there is an incredibly large number of orphaned children in Swaziland. And I said orphanages, but that really, I didn't mean to say that because we actually didn't visit orphanages. There aren't orphanages in Swaziland. What we did visit were orphan-headed homes, and I'll talk more about that in just a minute. By comparison, you can look at the population distribution of men and women in the age range, and I think this sort of paints a picture of the situation. Obviously, some of this is about the fact that Swaziland is a developing nation with some complicated healthcare enterprise and infrastructure, but certainly representative of the fact that many adults have simply died. I'm going to skip this slide. So let's talk about our time in Swaziland. So we landed in Johannesburg, and our first day there was a full day there. So we went to Soweto and visited many of the sort of iconic sites, the Nelson Mandela Museum, the Apartheid Museum. We had this fabulous tour guide. Her name was Mandy. I think she goes by the Magnificent Mandy. And when we told her exactly what we would be doing in Swaziland, by the way, she said, Swaziland is amazing for its massages. So you have to get a massage when you go to Swaziland. Never once did I see anything about massages anywhere in Swaziland. So I'm not sure where Mandy is going, but apparently they're really killer there. Anyway, when I told Mandy what we were going to be doing in Swaziland, she said, you know what, do you mind if we sort of like redo the entire afternoon's itinerary? Because I want to take you to a very special place where we're doing community education. And so Mandy took us to one of her homes, and it was essentially an art compound, right? And there were different installations that folks had done about African society, South African society, culture, language, etc. And it was a really, really phenomenal example of sort of community-engaged and local education. I probably will have to give a different presentation about that because there's so much to say about it. We also went to the Apartheid Museum, which, if any of you have been there, is a really tremendous display of human agency and resiliency during one of the most terrible things that happened in our history, which is apartheid. And so this is a picture, well, I guess you can't see it very well, unfortunately, but it's a burning field. And so when we get in the car the next day to drive to Swaziland, Annie asked us, so what do you think you're going to see? Like, what do you think the landscape's going to look like? And I know she was baiting us, because I know what she was wanting us to say is, you know, we're going to see jungles and elephants and lions and all of that stuff, right? Well, I had done my homework, and so I knew exactly what we would see, which would be a lot of fields. What I did not expect was that South Africa would be on fire as much as it was. Now, at first, I was sort of like panicked and jumped to the conclusion that this is climate change, and oh my God, just like Brazil, everything's on fire. But what it turns out is this is actually organized and carefully managed crop burning, right, and field burning, controlled burns, if you will. We were there in the winter, and so they were in the process of preparing crops for the next year. What I didn't expect, though, was that there would be burned crops literally for hundreds of miles on our way to Swaziland. And the amount of, sort of pollution and stuff that creates is something I think that had me thinking quite a bit. That night, I talked to my mom on the phone, and she was like, "What was it like? How was the ride? What did you see?" And I was like, "It was on fire. Everything was on fire." Swaziland, Eswatini, is a country, though, of immense beauty and enormous challenges. And I spoke to some of those challenges already. And what I'm going to do now is sort of take you through our experience in some of the schools and the community education environments that we were, and talk about some of these challenges. I am always, like I said early, sort of in a process of continually unpacking, because this was a really, really intense trip. Some of the things that we saw, some of the students that we worked with, some of the children that we got to meet, have had really, really harrowing experiences. And in spite of that, they come to us and to their education with such enthusiasm and energy and excitement that it really is, it really, really is beautiful. So one of the things that intrigued me most about working with Annie and her organization is the immense network of child-headed homes that she works with. And so her organization, Give Hope, Fight Poverty, works really closely and has had long-standing relationships with these children. When she told me we would be visiting child-headed homes, I was thinking, well, she says child, but kids don't live alone. And so I was thinking older kids. And well, most of them were older teenagers. There were lots of kids living without parents, right? And they were being taken care of by neighbors, by teachers, by village bogos, which is the word for grandmother. But they were living alone. Outside of the city, all of the land is called kingdom land. It's essentially the king's land. And the king has designated or appointed several chiefs across the country to sort of manage these lands in this district. One of the reasons kids don't leave their homes after their parents die is that if they leave their home, they will lose their home. And I mentioned that there's absolutely no infrastructure really in this country to support and take care of these kids, right? And so kids stay home and they learn how to live independently. And we'll see this reflected in some things that are happening in the schools there. This particular woman was Natondo, three children living independently, 100% in love with everything that has to do with English and English literature, especially. Her English was impeccable. She's just such a brilliant, brilliant mind, but living independently, raising her three children, and continuing to go to school. This is the other really interesting thing, is that many kids in school there are in school until they're 24, 25, 26, 27, because they sometimes have to stop school for several years. And in Swaziland, it's very particular, right? If you haven't finished fourth grade, you can't go on to fifth grade, no matter how old you are in terms of age. One of our first community education events was at Baban Public Hospital. We went to the children's wing. And I had prepared myself, because Annie had prepared us, about what we would see and what it would look like. This is the outside of the hospital. Of course, I don't have any pictures inside of the hospital. But there were maybe 15 or 20 children in this particular wing. The good news was that all of them were going to get out. And so there were no children who were there in perpetuity or necessarily sick or dying, although there are several children's hospices across the country. But we worked with kids all morning. We read to them. We did literacy work. We did craft work. We were the only ones in the room, along with family members. And this was something that I didn't know, again, about this particular situation, is that there aren't really nurses to speak of in Swaziland, right? And so family members, if you have somebody in the hospital, a family member is expected to be the caretaker, right, the nurse. So if a kid or family member has dysentery or something terrible, right, you're the one who's expected to clean them up, to provide food for them, et cetera. It's not like like it is here with the small army of nurses we have, right? And to think about the fact that we consider nursing shortages here, I mean, there's nowhere even near anything like that in Swaziland. We also went to Malinza Care Point, which is sort of a pop-up school in the rural community. This is Mrs. Dalini, who was the director of the school, was phenomenal in terms of providing really cool educational opportunities. We got to work with, I worked with the teenagers, and let me just tell you, like, I thought my jokes were really funny, and the teenagers were basically, like, not impressed, not amused. But we had a good time once I let them take charge. We had a really good time. I wanted to point out, I don't know if you noticed this poster that was hanging up behind Mrs. Dalini, which is this contamination cycle poster, right? When you think about the kinds of posters that we have up in our classrooms here in this country, right, you would never see something like this, right? But sanitation, access to clean water, the water pump in this small village had been broken for months, and so families had to go to the river, which essentially is in the middle of a desert, to get clean water. So you can imagine what that water looked like and what that water tasted like. Right? This is very real. This is a real example of the kinds of things kids are learning for self-preservation. We did ESL programming at the Care Point, which was a lot of fun. And we also went to the Malinza Community Center. We played games with the teenagers. We did some fun literacy work. Here's one of our education students. Whoops, sorry. Working with a group of teens. We ended up playing volleyball for a while with them. It was really phenomenal. This is Elangeni Schools, and when we take students in the future, this school will now be kind of our home base because of a partnership we're hoping to establish there. The school is a K-8 school, and half of the school was gone for a day on a field trip, and so we were just working with, I think it was like 4th through 8th graders. Again, we played lots of games, did lots of literacy work. They really wanted to be in selfies, which was, of course, cute and funny. We had a lot of fun with their language because I'm a language person, and so I'm always thinking about language and how it's made. And Siswati is full of morphemes, and so we talked a lot about morphemes and what they were. So the word for frog is sikoko. They also use glottal stops and clicks and all of that stuff, and it means leather jump or something like that, right? So it's a really literal fun language. Again, some of our students doing literacy work and games. The classes were really full. Each of the classes had about 40 students. I mentioned some of the unique challenges that are faced by this population. Swazi schools have responded by integrating agricultural programs into the schools, especially in the rural areas. And so all of the students learn how to essentially grow their own food. There were lots and lots of avocado trees, which fresh avocados are pretty amazing. We were there on Tuesday, and so if you look at, this was the primary school's lunch menu. Schools provide food for students, and Tuesday's menu item was umgushu, and I don't know if this video will play. Let's see. Our College of our Education students are practicing their language skills. We're going to work on that. So we actually, one cool thing that we got to do is we got to help in the lunchroom and prepare food for the 300 students. And so food consisted of ngushu, which essentially is sort of a soupy mixture of potatoes and onions and rice. I don't know if you can see this very well. There are maybe 8 or 9 onions on the table. There were about 5 or 6 potatoes, a few carrots. That was sort of cooked in a lot of water and added to rice. And what we did in the end was, this was like one of those like sort of harrowing and shocking moments of the trip, which was I think hard to experience and see, which is the school lunches were put in 5-gallon buckets, one bucket of this rice porridge mixture, one bucket of rice, and taken to the classrooms. And this is, again, I'm sort of checking myself because this is one of those experiences where I think as somebody who's doing this work and engaging in this work, right, we want to think hard about how we portray and what we talk about with respect to it. The principal of the school donning some of our Hawkeye teacher's gear. We also met with faculty leaders at Amati University, which is a teacher preparation program there, in the hopes of establishing continued partnerships and pipelines. Again, there are some really amazing community education and rural education work that they're doing, which will benefit our College of Education students. And they've asked us to help think about supporting them with respect to technology education, social-emotional learning, this kind of thing. Of course, no trip to Africa is complete without a visit to a game reserve, and so we went to Hulani Game Reserve. Saw a couple of pretty exciting animals. Mantega Cultural Village, which showed, was all about sort of the history of Swaziland, the culture, the people, the way villages were organized to represent patriarchal structures. So this is kind of a silly picture, but I'm about to end the presentation, but we were getting ready to leave. This was our last day, and this peacock was like would not stop following me. I don't know if I smelled like food or something, but anyway, it was like following me around everywhere. We were at a glass factory, and we finally were getting ready to leave. Everybody was in the car except for me. I was like in the front seat, but I was standing outside of the car loading stuff, and this peacock let out like the loudest, like scariest screech I have ever heard in my life. And I thought it was like attacking me. And so I yelled out a huge scream, and everybody in the car jumped like 5 feet and spilled coffee and everything. And anyway, Swazi peacocks, do not mess around. Keep your distance. In the end, Swaziland is really, really a beautiful country. If you have a chance to go, I really encourage you to go. It's a beautiful place. It's a complex place. It's a place where I think we're forced to problematize the way that we think about and see the world, the way that we think about and see education, and the opportunities and paths that we provide for people. This was on the wall at the Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg and Soweto, and it's We Are Storytellers. And I have a couple of slides after this, but sort of I'm going to end cap the Swaziland presentation by saying, our work in the College of Education is to help people find a voice to create and share their stories. And one of the best ways that we can do that is to get them out in the community, interacting with people, engaging in experiences and opportunities that are different than their own. And we are all storytellers in this journey and in this process together. So just a couple of cool announcements that I'll make relative to this is that we'll be soon launching a TLC certificate in global education for pre-service teachers, and that will give our teachers, a sort of a credential as they enter into classrooms, because we know if you look at any school district's website, vision, mission, et cetera, there is something about internationalization or something about preparing students to work in sort of the global age and in the global environment, right? And I think that we have to do a better job of doing that. And lastly, and most excitingly, last Friday, so just a couple of days ago, we launched in Iowa City Community School District in partnership with several community organizations, including the Neighborhood Centers of Johnson County, Iowa City Compassion, UAY, I'm forgetting like eight of them, but just all kinds of neighborhood organizations that are serving international populations and communities, a SEAL of Biliteracy curriculum and course. And so these students pictured here are part of the inaugural class who will earn from the state of Iowa a SEAL of Biliteracy. So they're demonstrating competencies in English and another language. In addition to that, Iowa City has taken the bold step, and this was where our work was with them all summer, in creating a curriculum that is infused not only in language proficiency, but also in cultural engagement and community engagement. So students in this program will not only be gaining advanced language skills and proficiencies, but we're asking them to use those language skills and integrate them with community agencies and partners. And so students will be developing projects over the course of a year. Sometime this spring, we'll be announcing, and I'll be sure to share it with the organization, sort of a fair and a carnival that celebrates the students' projects. If you see projects across the community that have the SEAL of Biliteracy tag on them, please try to go, because I think there's nothing more that we can do to validate these students than by supporting them. They are, after all, the ones who have to solve the problems that we've created. So thank you, everybody, very much. It's been great to be here. And I guess questions?
Do you think your students would be interested in coming to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council presentations? And if so, how could we reach out to them and invite them to our programs?
That's easy. I'll just require it. No, our students, all students in the College of Education Teacher Ed program have a professional development program to complete, and that includes attending events in the community, some that we organize, but we are always advertising community events. So I'll just be sure to capture those events and put them on our calendar.
How are you including the 17 UN dependent, development goals in your program?
Good question. So the wonderful thing about the development goals is that they are universal. And so I think that sometimes there's this belief that the work that the UN does in sustainable development doesn't really apply to our work or doesn't really apply to our context here in the United States. I think, though, you would be hard-pressed to not find something, a topic of relevance for each of those sustainable development goals. Clean, potable drinking water, Flint, Michigan, right? Access to education, incarcerated individuals, right? I mean, there are so many ways to connect that to our curriculum. What we will be doing, and the work that I'm really excited to do with our faculty, is what we call a curriculum deep dive, which is getting into each individual course and looking at each individual syllabus and sort of linking these goals, the value statements from AACU. And there are, by the way, many others that we're including, of course, in the short presentation time we have today. I couldn't include all of that work or frameworks for helping us think about and understand ways to do this and to do it well.
This question says, I understand study abroad. Could you explain more about study away?
Yeah, I can't actually tell you who coined the term study away, although I know that there is a person who did. And it's the idea that abroad really speaks to going someplace outside of the United States. Study away recognizes the value in and recognizes the fact that there are opportunities very locally for us to engage in populations and cultures that are perhaps different than we are. I don't know if you've been to the Meskwaki settlement in Iowa, but there's a school there. It's the Meskwaki Settlement School. And it's a very, very cool, very progressive, very just amazing curriculum, right? And that would be an example of an opportunity for our students to study, maybe not necessarily abroad. We don't have to go to Eswatini, Africa to learn some of the goals that we hope to learn, right, or some of the overlap here with developmental or global education goals. The global is actually the local. And I know that some people hate this term, right? The global or whatever. It does kind of sound gross. But there are definitely these connections. And this is an important thing for us to work harder on, right? That study abroad doesn't have to necessarily. We can still accomplish a lot of the goals and the outcomes that we hope to accomplish by staying right here in our own communities.
This is the College of Education in Eswatini. Please say more about what it means to problematize in this context.
So when I use the word problematize, I'm talking about troubling some of our assumptions about what education looks like, troubling some of our assumptions about what schools look like, how they function. In other words, it's to sort of think about the structures and the ways of being that we have come accustomed to or that we accept as the norm, and to actually encourage our students to get into those spaces, into those concepts that might shake up the way that they think about or see the world, right? It's all about, and we know that some of the most significant and impactful learning happens when we create this sense of dissonance, right? This cognitive dissonance with people, right? When we confront students with ideas and experiences that are different than their own. The important thing, though, and I think it's important, especially nowadays, given how poorly we, many adults, seem to be doing this in our country, especially those who are getting a lot of attention, to provide students opportunities and ways to be in those moments or to sit in difference with one another in a way that's peaceful, in a way that's respectful, in a way that recognizes that we can still be in community and share difference.
Is there tuition in Swaziland or Eswatini for kids to go to school? And also, is there a difference in school attendance for boys and girls?
That's a good question. School is not free in Swaziland. In fact, school is quite expensive. Even at public schools, there is an expectation that students will have uniforms, that they will come with some supplies. I think that tuition for a year in Elangeni, again, which is a public school, it is one of the top-rated schools in the nation, but it's a public school in the rural area outside of Baban, it was nearly $500 a year, $500 US a year. Now, I have not had to register kids for school in the last couple of years, and I'm not sure if anybody else in this room has either, but I do know that I think $500 is more than what we would pay to register kids for public schools. And that's, of course, is a barrier. The second part of the question was about attendance rates between boys and girls. Not really. But I have to be careful by saying, like, I don't know if that is because of the schools that we were in. There are definitely, in this very patriarchal society, there are definitely some challenges for young women especially to overcome. And we know that those structures, when they are systemic in nature, aren't just waiting for women when they get to adult married life, so to speak, but that they're inherent in every part of the system. And we did see those young women, again, also persisting in spite of some of these adversities and challenges.
Okay, there's several questions here, so I'll read them individually. Do you work with Peace Corps programs?
Yes.
Do you want to say?
Yeah, no. The Peace Corps representatives on our campus have been coming to the College of Education for years. We have usually several presentations. So what Peace Corps used to do would just be come and do an informational session. And I had a conversation with them a few years ago where I basically said, I actually don't know that that's an effective way to get students into the Peace Corps, which is ultimately their goal. And so what I suggested was that they come and tell a story. They come and tell their story, sort of the theme of my presentation. And indeed, it did make for a much more dynamic and interesting presentation. We want our students to take something away. We sometimes call this, like, you know, taking away a nugget from everything they attend. And I know that the Peace Corps presentations that have been happening in the college have not only been giving students some things to think about. You know, one of the things we noticed is that students who go into teacher education tend to come from this region, right? And so students, like, don't go far away to become a teacher. They tend to stick close to home. And they tend to go into teacher education and become teachers because they themselves had a pretty good school experience. And the kind of school that they imagine teaching in, for the most part, of course not true for everybody, is the kind of school that they went to, right? And so this creates, kind of a pipeline, I guess, for local schools, et cetera. But there are so many different kinds of schools and different places to do teaching. And one of the most exciting things that has happened as a result of our work taking more students abroad and away is that they're now thinking about not just staying here in Iowa to teach, right? For the most part, they want to come back to Iowa to teach, right? But they're now excited about going away. And what a tremendous benefit for our students to get teachers who have gone away to teach in Costa Rica, Botswana. We have students in Qatar this year, right, who are coming back to Iowa with this tremendous and really exciting international experience. So that was the first question, I think.
Yeah, put a couple these other ones together. Are U of I students coming with high school languages? I think that's what that is. And do you use Cliff Messon's wider net program for technology?
Can I see the card?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
We do use Cliff's work. In the two projects that I've done most recently, we did not, however, for no reason other than I sort of have lost track of Cliff, actually, and his work, the major source of income for Swaziland. The major source of income for Swaziland would be its manufacturing and agriculture, although it doesn't really seem very clear, like, what exactly that is. And so when you talk about Swaziland's biggest export, it would actually be handicrafts, And the last question is, are UI students coming with high school languages? This is a really good and important question, and that is less and less. And so, unfortunately, in spite of our work to internationalize and do things like create students and environments for students to be globally engaged citizens, our students seem to be coming out of high school with less and less language proficiency. If any of you are familiar with Iowa City, in fact, you know, I said I was a German teacher here, but you may know the fate of the German program in Iowa City, right? Short-sighted decision-making to close a program which wasn't about enrollments or wasn't about funding. I think that, and we're working hard with the State World Language Association to think about new opportunities to create a roadmap for languages, potentially in the state of Iowa, which would help give what I seem to think of as administrators and school boards and citizens who are participating in this decision-making process a way to think about how important it is for us to leverage language, foreign and second language education as a way to boost our state's economy. There are some really phenomenal statistics about the amount of foreign expenditure in Iowa. And we know that the more that we pull away from that, the more that we will all be negatively and adversely impacted by that.
Well, unfortunately, well, I would love to listen for the rest of the afternoon. Our time is up. And so we must conclude our program, but I want to give a great big thanks to Will Coghill-Behrens for this wonderful presentation. So please join me. I also want to thank our sponsors, the University of Iowa's International Programs, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their generous support. And also thank today's special sponsors, Midwest One Bank, Ken and Alice Atkinson, and Conrad Schultz, and we thank City Channel 4 for making our programs available to the viewing audiences. And Will, now as a small token of our appreciation, I am thrilled to give you our very highly coveted Iowa City Foreign Relations Council mug. So enjoy.
This is exciting.
Thank you. Good. Cheers. So, and with that, we are adjourned.